Lieutenant Colonel Alan Worsop, Royal Army Medical Corps, is tutor in general practice at the Royal Army Medical College and also regimental medical officer of the 2nd Battalion Scots Guards. It was as regimental medical officer of the Scots Guards that he went to the Falkland Islands. Alan, can you tell me, first of all, when you first knew that you were definitely going to the Falklands?
Yes, I remember very well because I was on holiday at the time, let us say on leave, and I had a telephone call from my commanding officer after I'd been on leave for about a week, telling me just before I was due to go away to the Lake District with my family that my presence was urgently required back at Chelsea Barracks, because he told me then that we were involved in the current excitement. And of course we all knew what that was at the time, because it had been proposed that forces be sent to the South Atlantic, and as it turned out, a brigade of regular army troops were going to go down, as it were, the second wave or backup force to the initial task force which had left on Invincible and Victorious and Canberra. In fact, it's curious that I and my family, as a sort of patriotic gesture, since I was on leave, went down to Portsmouth and Southsea to see the first wave of the task force leave. And I well remember seeing the carriers Invincible and Victorious disappear into the fine heat haze of an afternoon in April when they left, little thinking at the time that I was to see those same carriers under very different circumstances a few weeks later. And this was a very sort of curious experience, and it reminded me of one or two other things that have happened in my life where events have, as it were, passed over the consciousness as being in somehow, what should we say, foretelling the future. One got a sort of preview of the future at the time. And I couldn't believe that this was all that I was going to see of these particular ships disappearing. I somehow, for a few microseconds, had a vision of somehow being involved in this situation, whereas at the time, because we were 2nd Battalion Scots Guards doing household and public duties in London, there was no reason to think at that time that we would have anything to do with any of the goings on in the Falkland Islands. And so, although it was with some surprise that I got the telephone call from my commanding officer about our possible involvement, and yet it wasn't a surprise because of the feelings I had on those days, on that day when I went down to Portsmouth to see the fleet leave. And we went down there simply because I was on leave at the time, and the opportunity was there, and the family were home, and it seemed a good opportunity to show one's support for the boys that were going south. So that's really how I came to be involved. And after the phone call from my commanding officer, I came into the barracks and got involved in the preparatory work, first of all for before going down on Exercise Welsh Falcon at Brecon in South Wales, followed after the exercise by a few days leave, and then setting out in the Queen Elizabeth II on the 12th of May on our journey south to join the others that have gone before us.
Yes. I seem to remember you had quite a send-off, but it must have been the very divided loyalties that you in fact left.
Well, I was very conscious that although one was in the army, because we were really in a peacetime army with an emergency role from time to time in the rest of the world, in particular Northern Ireland, I was very conscious of the fact that I'd been perhaps too long a peacetime soldier, and the realities of, as it were, living by the sword were beginning to catch up with one. And here was the other side of the coin. I mean, an exciting and interesting career in medicine in the army and taking one to various parts of the world was fine, but there was also a duty and a price to pay in that one was might well have to put one's life and the parenthood of one's family on the line because one served the Queen, and one had to come to terms with this particular emotion. Not that I think that anyone on the task force had any difficulty in this respect. I can honestly say that 999 people out of 1,000 on that task force were 100% behind the effort they were involved in, even though they knew their journey was a long and hazardous one, and that the support they could expect from UK that could be sent after them to help them would be minimal. What they didn't take and what they didn't have, they would have to do without, and improvisation was going to be the keynote.
Yes. And what was it like being on a luxury liner under those conditions? And
well, there again, it was one of the great paradoxes of the whole operation, that one knew one was in for an uncertain, painful, difficult, dangerous time ahead, which would inevitably follow if the peace negotiations, which were going on at the time, which we heard about on the World Service, didn't come to anything. So there was the contrast of going to what could possibly be one's death, or certainly an absolute hellhole of activity. At the same time, one was living in the lap of luxury, and the contrast was a great one. But rather than lull us into a state of not about the future, not planning for it, I rather think that the effect all the luxury living on the QE2 had was to focus one's mind on the contrast that was about to take place when one got off the ship and got onto dry land. And I think redoubled everyone's efforts under ideal circumstances prior to getting there. One had lots of time to think through the problems that one imagined might happen, and also to iron out details of organisation, relationships with one's colleagues, which were going to prove important when one actually got down there. What I mean by this is that we were living literally cheek by jowl with everyone in the brigade. There can seldom have been a longer and closer association in one place of a brigade of regular troops. And we had the opportunity to get to know one another very well and work through our various problems before we actually got to the theatre of operations. Mm. The only problem was, of course, the limitations on training, which presented itself with being on a ship.
Yes.
But this wasn't too bad from the medical point of view, because many of the things we wanted to do in terms of training, and in particular first aid training for the men under my medical care, many of these things, in fact, were ideally done in a state of expectancy that the troops were in, travelling to the South Atlantic with time to train and the opportunity to train. And so from some points of view, it was a godsend, because there was the opportunity to really involve oneself in very serious, life-saving first aid training with all the troops in the battalion, in a situation in which they were motivated by the fact that they were going to have to put this knowledge into operation pretty soon, and their life and the life of their comrades might depend on it. So their cooperation was total, and their dedication was total, and knowledge about first aid was absorbed very easily. So really this time spent on QE2 did mean that when I got to the Falkland Islands, I could really feel that if I was killed, or the rest of my battalion medical centre, the regimental aid post, if they were killed or put out of action, it wouldn't matter in terms of first aid care for the injured and wounded. That would go on, because virtually everyone in the battalion had been trained in what we came to call battlefield first aid, which I believe is somewhat like the similar first aid that is taught in the American Army. It is purely taught troops going into battle with the idea of doing the right things for the standard injuries that one receives in battle in order to save and sustain life prior and during evacuation to second and third line medical facilities. This was, in fact, a great comfort to me to know that when I arrived in the Falkland Islands, the basic life-saving things in terms of training and first aid had been done, and that anything extra we could do as a regimental aid post, or in my case, a medical officer, were going to be over and above that basic situation which had been satisfied.
I think your first stop, in fact, was at Freetown, Alan, and then on to Ascension. Did you have a fairly uneventful journey up to that stage?
From the military point of view, very uneventful. We didn't actually land at Ascension Island, but we cruised up and down about 15 to 20 miles from the shore. We were told at the time, because it, in fact, reduced a submarine threat, which was thought to be possible at that time. But why it should be that we should stay so far from shore, none of us could really explain in our own minds, and were perhaps too fearful to express openly. It seemed a good idea to get near the shore if there was a threat of a submarine, rather than a long way from it. Perhaps other people could explain this. So we didn't call it Ascension Island, but we did actually see it in the mists of the tropical heat. Which brings me on to one or two of the problems we had on the journey between Portsmouth and South Georgia. The things that stand out in my mind are the number of medical illnesses which we had. This was the time when it seemed to me that most people who were going to be ill or injured themselves from natural causes did so during this journey south, with all the intensive training that people were doing in narrow confined spaces. And unfortunately, one or two people did injure backs or break limbs, and as a result had to be evacuated when we got to Ascension Island. And without exception, they were all very angry towards me as their doctor for in some way being the instrument of their leaving their comrades and leaving the task force. And one felt very sad about seeing them lift off by helicopter and go to the medical facility at Ascension Island. Fortunately, these weren't too many, and the details of numbers are in my report. Curious enough, pneumothorax, which must be fairly rare surgical medical emergency in young men, occurred twice in my own battalion on the journey south, and there didn't seem to be any real reason why this was, except out of sheer chance. But it just shows you, in any situation in which you are a doctor, even though the standard of living is high, serious medical conditions can occur and have to be provided for. Fortunately, on board Queen Elizabeth II, we had, if anything, too many doctors. I think the numbers were something like 16 or 18, including two surgeons and indeed the two Cunard doctors with their ship's hospital. So there was no lack of care going down on the QE2.
What is pneumothorax that you mentioned?
Well, this is a condition in which spontaneous pneumothorax, in which, for no apparent medical reason, the lining of the lung, the pleura, the lung pleura splits and air escapes from the lung into the surrounding potential airspace that is over the lung, between the lung and the chest wall. And air collects, and as the air collects, the pressure rises and it presses on the lung. To a degree where, if this is not treated, the air pressure can, as it were, prevent the lung expanding and therefore reduce the respiratory capacity of the individual, and in its extreme form can cause anoxia and death.
Mm. What about sunburn?
Sunburn wasn't a problem, I recall, at all. What we did have, of course, was All the training was centred on physical fitness, and this meant running round the promenade deck, which you just could do in a circuit, except it was a bit constricted at 1-2 points, but it was possible to run all the way around the ship. And the nearer we got to the tropics, of course, the greater was the effort made in terms of working against the heat and humidity that was there at the time. And when people began to carry packs on their backs and carry weapons and extend their physical fitness capability, it did cause a handful of heat exhaustion casualties, where because of loss of fluid and salt and so on, people become dehydrated and their salt balance becomes disturbed, and this leads to collapse and weakness, which is a medical emergency. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, there was no problem about this. This was a situation readily and easily corrected with intravenous fluids. And it was an expected event. There weren't too many of these, and the military people did modify their training to allow for this as far as possible. But training had to go on.
Yes. And then, of course, within another 5 or 6 days, you were at the other extreme of climate yet again, and approaching South Georgia.
Yes, that fortunately was not a very long phase. It seemed to stay quite warm until we were about sort of 3 or 4 days from Georgia, when, as you say, the mist suddenly appeared and the sea changed colour from the deep blue to more slaty blue, and the flying fish disappeared. It was, funnily enough, it was only after I came back from the South Atlantic I learnt that exocet, a word we were constantly to hear, means flying fish in French, but nobody mentioned that at the time, even though we were looking overboard from the QE2, spotting flying fish on most of the journey through the tropical parts. Little did we think then we were looking at the enemy in a big way. One incident I will mention is that we had a call at Freetown, as you know, and because we were there, and this is a Bellaries area, everyone had to take a full prophylactic course of anti-malarial paludrine tablets, which threw great strains on our medical resources when you consider that people involved have to have 30 days treatment, and this was everyone on the ship. But there were enough tablets to go around, thanks to supplies which I was able to get from 16 Field Ambulance and from the Cunard stocks on board, so that was no problem at the time. We did have a problem later on when people were actually in the combat area and still should have been taking their paludrine tablets. Most of them did, but because of the wet and damp getting in at the supplies that one was carrying, it did mean that there were difficulties about taking malaria tablets to the full end of the course.
Yes, because 28 days after leaving Freetown, you were well and truly ensconced on the Falklands, weren't you?
Yes.
Before we get to that stage, perhaps, what was your first view of South Georgia? Was the mist clear enough for you to be able to see the island itself?
No, we went through quite a lot of mist for the 2 days prior to getting to Georgia, and one was conscious of getting near land. In fact, I could convince myself that I could smell icebergs, which is something you're supposed to be able to do. I don't smoke now, and my sense of smell is fairly keen, and I reckon I could smell icebergs, which is something I remember people on board the Titanic doing at the time, that they were near icebergs, and I found this quite a thrilling situation. I didn't actually see any icebergs getting near Georgia because of the mist, but when we actually got into Westmoreland Bay, I think it was, Gritvik and South Georgia, I saw icebergs there for the first time in my life, and I saw glaciers coming down to the sea, and this was a very thrilling experience. In fact, we arrived in the dark, and it wasn't until light came that I was able to see one's surroundings. But
did you yet know that you were definitely going to the Falklands, or?
Well, that's very interesting, because you see, all the time we were going down there, well, this was against the background of a changing political scene on the from the United Nations, which we heard about on the World Service, And although we heard when we were on the QE2 that the, for instance, there was an attack on Pebble Island by the SAS and Special Boat Service and so on, we still thought, many of us, that it couldn't really be, it was an unreal situation. We wouldn't actually be fighting, we wouldn't land on the Falkland Islands, and the QE2 would be turned around and we would return home. Many of us thought that this would happen. I personally didn't. I felt that President Galtieri was so entrenched in his position and our opposition was so absolute that a confrontation was bound to occur. But lots of people did feel that I think we're going to turn around. So that when we arrived at South Georgia, this was the first stage in realising that we were really getting awfully near. Up until then, one could perhaps put such thoughts to the back of one's mind. But arriving at South Georgia and the change in the weather and the mist and the cold that you mentioned brought it home to one that we were really getting into southern climes and getting awfully near the scene of operations.
And when did you first know that you would definitely be landing in the Falklands?
Well, at South Georgia, we transshipped from QE2 and I think they were North Sea trawlers that were available over to Canberra, which was also in Gritviken Harbour at the time, where she'd been since having gone in for the first time to San Carlos Bay, where we knew by that time that the initial landings had taken place and that the parachute battalions and the Marines were already engaged in fighting. So we transferred to Canberra, and it was after Canberra set sail that we were given details about our own landing, which was to be in the same area as the initial brigade landings, in other words, in the San Carlos area. And the plan of what we were going to do when we landed and where and when was revealed to us at this stage.
How did you get the news of what had been going on the islands up to now? I mean, through the World Service?
Communications, I believe, with the Queen Elizabeth II had their difficulties on the journey south. And really, if one listened to the World Service, one learnt as much as one was told, in fact, officially, about the progress of military operations. First, we heard about Pebble Island, as I say. That was interesting, because later I went to Pebble Island. And then we heard about the parachutist's success while we were on Canberra at Goose Green, which was a tremendous morale boost, because it became apparent that these people were beatable. You know, they weren't going to take over land and hold on to it forever and a day. They were vulnerable, and once they were shown to be vulnerable, then I'm sure this had a great factor in raising our morale. This was a great factor in raising our morale. The World Service was compulsory listening for anyone who wanted to hear about what was going on. Really, we weren't told a lot more other than what was on the World Service.
So you went towards San Carlos on the Canberra and disembarked from there to...
Yes, I remember very well. As we got towards the total exclusion zone, everyone was waiting to see the first of the support ships of the first wave of the task force, and there it was. We sailed through the defensive box that these ships were in the total exclusion zone, which was a couple of hundred miles, as you know, from the Falkland Islands themselves, where these ships were concentrated. And there it was that I saw Invincible and Victorious, and these other support ships, which I'd seen leave Portsmouth a few weeks earlier. And we sailed through there and made final preparations for our landing, which we then knew was going to be at the San Carlos Settlement Beach, which I think is Blue Beach. And we were told, and this in fact happened, that Canberra would go in by night and there was a possibility of us not all getting off at the first wave. Some might get out and land, and then because of the danger of air attack in San Carlos water, Canberra would have to leave and then come back again at night to discharge the rest of the brigade. But as things turned out, the whole brigade, I think, pretty well the whole brigade got off at that first lift. Certainly the Scots Guards all left Canberra, and we got into Royal Marine run landing craft for the journey from Canberra at the north end of San Carlos water for the journey south towards San Carlos settlement, where we in fact went ashore. We landed at a jetty in San Carlos settlement and stepped straight from the landing ship onto the jetty, loaded down with what seemed like a ton of kit, and walked slowly and steadily and carefully along the mouldering jetty towards the shore. And it was really quite something to actually put one's foot on Falkland soil after such a build-up. One felt almost like the first man on the moon in a small way.
Was it a fairly quiet landing, or did you have a reception committee for you when you arrived?
No, this was a big break, really, in that the day that Fife Brigade arrived in San Carlos water, it happened to coincide with a quiet period in terms of activity by the Argentinian Air Force in San Carlos Sound, and we took advantage of that. In fact, after we'd been there in the San Carlos area for a few days, of course, the weather turned very nasty, which excluded the Argentinian Air Force for a few more days, thus giving Fife Brigade a good respite and time to get its foot firmly on the shore, as it were. It was a fine day, a misty day, and gradually the mist cleared and one could see the ships around one in San Carlos water. What an impressive sight it was. I shall always, every time now I see a Royal Navy ship, I'll always feel that sort of solid, safe security one feels on seeing a grey ship when she's on your side and she's alert and bristling with radar and weaponry and there to defend you. It is a marvellous feeling. It's difficult to describe.
Yes.
And there were lots of such ships in San Carlos water, all strategically placed so as to cover one another and the approaches to the sound.
Did the whole brigade landed there and was on shore for several days, you see?
Yes, what happened was that the thing that stands out in my mind at that stage is the weight of equipment that we were all carrying. What you didn't carry, the battalion didn't have. And a battalion is really only a good battalion if it's a heavy battalion, if it can hit hard, if it can sustain itself and keep going. It's no good